Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The COVID-19 pandemic has been widely disruptive to nearly every aspect of our lives, and in many ways, our communities have managed to respond to varying degrees of success. That may be because, though this pandemic has been so widespread, deadly, and costly, we are somewhat used to disruptions. Think about how more frequently we experience severe weather events here, or how other parts of the country see more intense hurricanes or tornadoes. And we all know that a cyber attack on our workplace results in change. Similarly, we will find ourselves on the other side of this pandemic, and some of the ideas implemented during this devastating period can be built upon. That's according to local firm Yard & Company, which created the Adaptive Place Toolkit to guide communities in their response, using Cincinnati as an example. Yard & Company principal Kevin Wright talked to me earlier about it, and here's our pre-recorded conversation. Joining me now is Kevin Wright. He is a principal at Yard & Company. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been on to talk about the term placemaking and how communities can better use their public realm. And now you and your partner, Joe Nickel, over there at Yard & Company have come up with the Adaptive Place Toolkit. This has come out in response to the pandemic. We've seen how the pandemic has impacted the way we use public space. And I think probably from your perspective, we're using public space in a better way. We're eating in the streets rather than driving in them now. And while it's unfortunate why we're doing that, it is interesting to see. Talk a little bit about what you've learned during this pandemic and how you're applying it to what you're calling the Adaptive Place Toolkit.
Right. Well, it's you're right that we have completely reoriented our thinking around what is public space and sort of this mixture of private and public space. When the pandemic hit in March, as a small, you know, boutique company, we were a little worried. Obviously, the economy tanked, and we said, "Oh wow, is our phone going to keep ringing?" And after about a couple weeks, it started ringing, and it turns out that, having been a firm that worked creatively in the public realm around making streets safer or building temporary outdoor seating and helping to solve problems for towns related to that sort of thing, that when the pandemic hit, people started calling and saying, "Hey, can you help us think about our reopening strategies?" And so we were brought in. The best example is the city of Norfolk, Virginia. We were brought in to completely help them manage that those strategies. And it started with what are now commonly known by the everyday people as parklets. It was first supporting businesses in the downtown area and helping them expand their restaurants and bars and cafes outside, which, as you mentioned, creates more space during a time of spatial distancing, but also creates this renewed sense of vibrancy in the city that basically makes the statement that sidewalks aren't just for walking and parking spaces aren't just for parking and streets aren't just for cars.
I'm so glad you mentioned the term parklet, Kevin, and just so our listeners know, in case they're not familiar, I'll try to define it. I mean, you basically take a parking space in a business area or in a downtown, and you turn it into a little park-like area, a place where you can sit and enjoy the outside. And I have to say, it was about 5 or 6 years ago where Covington did a parklet project across its downtown area, and I covered that, and it was extremely controversial for some restaurant owners who were complaining about losing one or two parking spaces on the street in a coveted area for parking in place of these parking spaces. They went to City Hall and complained about it. I'm wondering, now that we see just about every downtown restaurant utilizing outdoor space because of the restrictions on indoor dining, do you think this change in thinking is permanent?
I do. It's a yes and no kind of answer. I think historically, when and it's a great example, the Covington example, because those were really beautiful parklets, and it was ahead of its time in many ways. Whenever you're doing a planning exercise and you're talking about growth and change, the first thing that always comes up historically is parking. People worry about parking really before they need to worry about it. And that it creates bad decision-making, frankly, in towns and neighborhoods. I think the pandemic has made us realize that the world does not end if you take a few parking spaces away. And I think even those who were big advocates for easy parking and accessible parking have realized in their own neighborhoods and cities that they are willing to give up a parking spot to support their local business that they love. And B, they're willing to give it up to be able to go out and eat and dine with their friends and family again. And so I think we saw that in the first wave of the pandemic, and it's continued, although it's winter now, so it's a bit harder. I do think a lot of that mentality will stick around. I think it depends on the place itself, but even in Cincinnati, which is pretty auto-oriented, you're seeing Mayor Cranley and the city make their parklets permanent and putting a pretty significant investment into that. And so I think if Cincinnati's the bellwether, which it makes sense that it is, I think that means that across the country, you'll see a lot more permanency around this kind of thinking.
We're talking with Kevin Wright, a principal at Yard and Company. His firm recently launched the, Adaptive Place Toolkit. The Adaptive Place Toolkit, developed in partnership with the University of Notre Dame's Kellogg Institute. How did that partnership come about in developing this with Notre Dame?
Well, my partner, Joe Nickel, went to Notre Dame, and so we had that built-in connection. He went to the School of Architecture there, and they had reached out to us because they had seen our work across the country related to placemaking and adapting to the pandemic, and connected us with Joshua Pine, who became a fellow with the Kellogg Institute through Yard. And we just started brainstorming with him. What are we, you know, what are we learning during all this? What are we seeing? And what emerged from that was we said that, you know, there we're learning that the places that are the most adaptive, the most nimble, are not only surviving the pandemic, they're thriving, they're growing during it. And so we said, well, is this something we could measure? And so we said, let's look at Cincinnati. The Cincinnati area is sort of a beta test for this, and we started building it out.
Okay, so I received a presentation that you all put together, a PowerPoint, and I've looked through it, and I thought it was interesting the way that you very optimistically approached the pandemic. I mean, as we noted at the beginning, a lot of the responses to the economic impact have followed a lot of your ideas all along on how to better use public spaces. And one of the slides says, because they are long and hard to predict, pandemics create innovation leap years. Could you tell us what that means?
Right. There are a lot of ways to dig into that. I think we are optimistic about it. Obviously, the pandemic has been horrible in many ways, but it also has made us have a better understanding about what we love and what we care about when it comes to our communities and our towns and our friends and our neighbors. And so, you know, there are a lot of theories about the future post-pandemic, you know, floating out there. We really believe that it has acted as an accelerant for many of the placemaking innovations that were already sort of starting to occur in some places, but now they're front and center in even the smallest of towns in the middlest, you know, part of the country. And so it really is an innovation leap year in that sense when you have towns. I was just recently in my hometown in southern Missouri, and there were, you know, bringing it back to parklets, there were really nice parklets sitting outside. And that is a town that you would have had 100 people with pitchforks showing up to a meeting for taking away parking in a downtown area that is doesn't have a lot of parking. So, you know, whether it's parking, whether it's, you know, rethinking how to build a public space or a park, we really rethinking place management, you know, the places, the neighborhoods that didn't have someone waking up every day thinking about place management and how to manage or operate a district or a neighborhood, I think realized that that's a big shortage for them. So I think you're going to see a lot of innovation around how places work and how they operate and how nimble and adaptive they can be moving forward.
Well, Kevin, I don't think you have to go to southern Missouri to find any community that might show up at the city building with pitchforks angry over any loss of parking. And I think right here at home, Cincinnati, right, and the urban cities in northern Kentucky, and obviously you're talking about this phenomenon spreading out into the suburbs, even in the smaller communities in the exurbs. Is a community like ours, Cincinnati and greater Cincinnati in general, that does not have a lot of public transportation options, so we are very car reliant, Are we less poised to be ready for a permanent adaptation to these new trends that emerged during the pandemic?
No, I wouldn't think about it that way at all. I think it's all about leadership and priorities. And I think there has been some positive signs of that regionally, not just in Cincinnati, but in the river cities as well, and even the suburbs that you mentioned. I think one of the advantages of being so auto-oriented, frankly, and building streets that are wider than they need to be and that are geared towards getting people in and out of a city as opposed to staying in a town and spending money, that creates the opportunity to have more space to play around with. And so when you think about streets cutting through Cincinnati, like Reading Road or Gilbert or Victory Parkway or, you know, William Howard Taft, these arterial roads that have historically been built to be too wide, they cut through the middle of mixed use neighborhoods that are trying to grow and are trying to attract new investment. And so in many ways that makes them very adaptable. It's just a matter of having the pieces in place to really be able to adapt those streets and those public spaces.
We're talking with Kevin Wright, principal at Yard & Company. It's a locally based firm that recently launched, in conjunction with the University of Notre Dame, the Adaptive Place Toolkit. I notice that this toolkit includes audit action advancement, audit of city neighborhoods to figure out where and how to focus adaptation efforts, action to adapt what you already have to serve new needs, and advancement of adaptive capacity and future development and infrastructure. I want to run through each of these. What does it mean to audit a neighborhood to figure out what you've got and how to adapt there?
Well, if you go to our website, you can click on an interactive map right now for Cincinnati, where we've run the data for Cincinnati. And that essentially is an audit. There are six indicators that we measure: convertible streets, access to social infrastructure, safe and active transportation, flexible mixed-use spaces, air quality, and nimble management. So you can zoom in on your neighborhood in Cincinnati and see how you score. So that's the audit, essentially. The audit can be adaptable, pun intended, I suppose, to different places. So the scoring criteria can change to make it more relevant to the on-the-ground problems that the city or the town is trying to solve. But essentially, that's the audit. So then it starts to tell you how adaptive you are and how adaptive you aren't in these areas, which then leads to thinking about action and how to implement change.
Well, I notice that because I'm looking at some of the slides that include this analysis of Cincinnati, and as it relates to convertible streets, which you define as those that may be modified and used for play, commerce, and moving about more spaced out, it looks like the neighborhoods that are more adaptable to converting those streets are the ones downtown. It seems the further you get away from the core, the more average or even below average they become. So is that a product of decades gone by?
It's mostly a product, and there, you know, we could dig into this a little bit more and add additional indicators, but one of the major indicators there, just to give you a sense of why it looks like that, is that streets that have a speed limit of 25 miles per hour or less. And I would guess that if you had folks from Westwood or Bond Hill or, you know, name your neighborhood here, that they would say that there are very few streets in their neighborhood other than primary residential streets that have speed limits that are less than 25 miles an hour. And it's really hard to adapt a street for people when historically the street has been a 40 to 50 mile per hour speed limit. And so I mentioned some arterials earlier that are mostly on the east side, but, you know, think about Hamilton, North Bend, you know, streets that remove parking, on-street parking during peak rush hour and are four or five lanes wide to get people out to the suburbs from their job downtown. Those streets are just a bit harder to adapt and just take a little bit more policy intervention than, say, you know, Main Street in downtown.
I thought it was interesting that the areas around downtown and the University of Cincinnati had the highest score when it comes to convertible streets. But when it comes to flexible mixed-use space, which you define as the percentage of area with safe and convenient access to a range of uses, services, and civic spaces, we see higher scores in the more eastern neighborhoods. So, I mean, again, some areas around UC and Avondale, but we're also seeing Walnut Hills in this, East Walnut Hills, Evanston, and Hyde Park start to score higher in that area.
That's right. It's this one is closely aligned with the idea of the 20-minute neighborhood, which is, the thought behind that is that, you know, building neighborhoods where you're a 20-minute walk from essentially everything that you need. And that requires a built environment that is very flexible, that it is has a variety of uses. And so you, when you look at that portion of the map, you start to see neighborhoods that not only have these central neighborhood business districts that are pretty robust, but also have seen investment in those neighborhood business districts over the last several years. That would be in the case of, say, Walnut Hills and places like Hyde Park, Mount Lookout, Marymount. You know, those have never really seen a downturn. And so they're very strong in that regard. And then there are places that have these neighborhood business districts, but just haven't seen a lot of investment yet into their core. And so there's a lot of opportunity there. So if you saw a neighborhood score low in that regard, that would, one of the action steps you would take would be to figure out how to start building demand and making investments into those mixed use districts.
Another area that you scored where the central business district downtown was a lower scoring area compared to the surrounding neighborhoods in Cincinnati was air quality. So it looks like some of the outer neighborhoods of Cincinnati proper scored better on the air quality rating than downtown did. And you mentioned a term called nimble management, and you do rate that of all the city's neighborhoods as well. Tell us what you mean by nimble management.
This is what I touched on a little bit earlier. In the Cincinnati context, we have a pretty robust community development corporation system. And a community development corporation, in essence, it changes from neighborhood to neighborhood. But in essence, they wake up every day. They are paid staff members who wake up every day thinking about the betterment and the improvement of the neighborhood. They're essentially problem solvers for the neighborhood. And so we measured nimble management based on communities that have those entities in place. And this is arguably, at least in my mind, I'm a little biased because I used to run a community development corporation. But
yeah,
this
you were
is
from
one
the
of the most
Walnut
important,
Hills.
Right, in Walnut Hills, that's right. And this is one of the most important aspects of being adaptive. If you look at a Walnut Hills or a College Hill, for instance, and you kind of look back over the last 10 to 11 months, you'll see that those CDCs, those community development corporations, completely shifted their focus the second the pandemic hit and started to problem solve around everything from access to food to rent assistance to parklets and programming and to small business support. And so if you don't have someone in your neighborhood who's helping think about think about problem solving and think about its future, it really does put you in a tough position when it comes time to adapt. I do think there are some communities, I don't want to just highlight CDCs, there are some communities who have volunteer-run organizations that are also very effective. But ultimately, some type of entity that's there to respond is really key.
And I note that when you aggregate all of the different areas that you analyze for neighborhoods, there aren't a lot of the 52 neighborhoods in Cincinnati that score the highest rating of well above average. The ones that do are mostly all clustered together. So we've got Over the Rhine, Mount Auburn, Walnut Hills, East Walnut Hills, Avondale, Coryville, and what's the area south of Clifton that you all abbreviate CUF? I always forget that. What is that?
Oh, yeah, Clifton University Heights.
Gotcha.
All right. Fairview. Yeah, I always forget it as well.
All right. All right. Our producer, our technical director, Josh, says Fairview. So that works for me. I apologize.
Fairview.
I live in Covington. Sometimes I get mixed up on the Cincinnati neighborhood. But also Northside, which is on the other side of Clifton on the map, of course. And it doesn't surprise anyone because it's got a lot of walkability there. But I was surprised to see Kennedy Heights on the northeast edge of town scoring very high as well. I mean, can you tell us anything about Kennedy Heights?
Well, it'd be hard for me to dig in too much into Kennedy Heights, but I will say, you know, they do have a CDC there. They have access to parks. They have pretty good streets. You know, it's a neighborhood that's not thought of very often, but it's a pretty pleasant neighborhood. It's well situated near other neighborhoods that are growing. I would say, though, that when you take a look at the map, it's important to note, because it's easy to look at it and start to think, oh, this is a measurement on how well people are doing. This is a measurement on the market demand for places. And there is a little bit of alignment there. But it really is not that. It's how adaptive you are to a crisis like a pandemic. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're the best neighborhood. This is not a ranking of who's best and who's worse. And so, you know, over time, as a planet, really, and as a country, we've gotten used to adapting to crises, whether they're economic crises, terrorist attacks, climate change crises. And a pandemic's different. A pandemic is one that doesn't just hit and you rebuild and move on. It hits and it changes the DNA of a place long term. It changes how it changes our patterns long term. And so this is about thinking through how to adjust in more of a long-term permanent way than just reacting and rebuilding after an event.
Kevin, it seems like we're at the point in this pandemic where we can really see the other side of it. We're starting to talk about it in real terms. The vaccines are rolling out. More people are getting shots in their arm. And hopefully we will see some normalcy very soon. Uncertain exactly on when that might be. But what do you, as someone in the field you're in, hope lasts the most? I mean, is there anything that we've done as local communities in our business districts or in our parks that you really hope last beyond the pandemic?
I think, yeah, that's a great question. I first off, I want to say I can't wait for some things to stop. You know, I miss the community potlucks, you know, the neighborhood events where you the happenstance of running into a neighbor on the street or at a restaurant, all those things that are really a core part of community building.
Or just seeing your neighbor's faces.
Right. So I think there's a social connection it just has to come back. But I do, I, from an economic perspective, I think there's been a real focus on spending your time and money in places that are local. I mean, obviously there's the Kroger delivery, there's the Amazon that I think will continue to be a trend where you're buying your paper towels and things like that in a very convenient and simple way. But I think this doubling down on if you're going out for dinner, you're going out for a drink, or you're buying flowers, you're whatever you might be doing in your day-to-day life that's more important to you, this doubling down on attaching an experience to that and buying from someone that you know who is in your neighborhood, I hope that continues, that we instead of spending our money in places that are not in our city or our region, we spend our money more carefully around some of the people we know and love in our neighborhoods. And I think that those local restaurants and retailers will have to double down on providing an experience when it comes to that type of shopping. And I think that experience, just to cap it off, ties into things like parklets, outdoor dining, which then has a ripple effect on the placemaking and the place experience of districts and neighborhoods, particularly in the urban environment, because they can offer an experience that newer communities in the suburban context really can't.
All right, Kevin, before we let you run in our last 30 seconds together, I know Yard & Company just acquired a property in Dayton, Kentucky. You're doing something special over there.
Right. We've launched something called The Garage over in Dayton, Kentucky, just across the river from downtown. And The Garage is an experiment in many ways in the future of live work. We don't believe that working from home is going to go away. We think that many aspects of that are going to stay. And when you think about what that means to your life, if you're working from home, sometimes you need to get out and just focus on work. Or if you're having a dinner party because you've been working at your house all week, maybe you don't want to have that dinner party at home. And so we've launched an on-demand, really easily rentable space by the hour for focused work, team events, and also community and family events over here in Dayton, Kentucky, and an old gas station, an old historic service station that provides a really interesting space to gather either safely during the pandemic, but also hopefully after, when we can all be a bit closer to each other.
Kevin Wright is a principal at Yard & Company, along with another principal there at Yard, Joe Nickel. They've created the Adaptive Place Toolkit, which is to be used as a guide to help neighborhoods and communities come out of this pandemic from a planning perspective stronger than they went in. It was created in conjunction with the University of Notre Dame. Kevin, always a pleasure to have you on. We've got a link to this presentation and the map of Cincinnati and some of those color-coded analyses at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Kevin, thanks again. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Vetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.